So hello,
hello,
Scott Ross. Welcome to the Art of VFX. So glad you're here with us today. Let's present just for the youngsters maybe who Scott Ross is quickly before we're gonna talk about today the state of this industry in 2013, the VFX industry. Let's not maybe go back to your early days in the sound business. You become the general manager at Island.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Tell us from there on.
Mid-1980s, general manager of ILM, wind up at ILM at a really critical time for the transition from optical photochemical compositing to digital. So really was involved with a small group of people at ILM that transitioned the company from the old style process to the modern age of digital work. And then I was with ILM till the early 90s. In the early 90s, I also wound up being the executive not only in charge of ILM, but also of Skywalker Sound and LucasArts Attractions and Editroid and Soundroid, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, most of Lucasfilm. And then in 1993, I left and I formed Digital Domain with my partners, Jim Cameron and Stan Winston, the character creature creator. And I ran Digital Domain and built Digital Domain from 1993 to about 2006, at which point we got an offer that we couldn't refuse, and I wound up selling the company to Michael Bay and a fellow by the name of John Texter and some of his associates, and then sat at the sidelines watching Digital Domain change and ultimately go out of business and become bankrupted. And now I teach and I write scripts and I try to get films produced and I travel around the world and I play a lot of rock and roll.
Very nice. So this shows us that you've been all the way to the top in Hollywood. You know them all. You've seen how this industry works deep side in. And we're going to get back to that. But like this now, we know that you know a lot about how this works. And maybe if we back a little bit, Digital Domain, so you spin from ILM, you create Digital Domain with James Cameron, and Stan Winston. Do Titanic, Fool Eyes.
Well, I think our first project was a logo for Tim Burton. Tim Burton decided that he was going to change the name of his company, and the company's name became Buried Alive. And so the first project in 1993 for Digital Domain is producing Tim Burton's logo for his company. The next project we do is a film called Color of Night, you know, with Bruce Willis. It's a small film, relatively speaking. And then the next big project we do is Jim Cameron's first movie with Digital Domain, True Lies. So in our first year, in 1993, from nowhere, just, you know, sort of me, and then all of a sudden we become a company with several hundred employees. We're nominated for an Academy Award for True Lies. We win the Gold Clio Lion at Cannes for our commercial for Jeep. And we win a Grammy Award for the Rolling Stones' Love is Strong. So out of nowhere, this company is built and overnight is right at the top of the pop within 6 to 9 months.
Very nice.
It was heady.
And then you have a good run with Digital Domain. And then, at some point, there's a separation, right? You three at the top, and then you disagree on something, and some partners go away. Anecdotes about this? Or?
Yeah, I mean, understand that when we say Jim and Stan and Scott were the founders of Digital Domain, Jim lent his name to Digital Domain, which brought us the credibility of getting our financing. And because he was a director that did really big movies with lots of visual effects, brought us projects as well, True Lies being the first one. Stan, his involvement with Digital Domain was really peripheral. The reason he was involved was because he had just done Jurassic Park, and on the heels of Jurassic Park, ILM was getting all of the press because of the computer dinosaurs. And Stan felt that his career and what he was doing was over, even though he designed and his company designed the dinosaurs and the animatronics. He saw the tides changing. And he and Jim Cameron were very, very close friends, having worked on a number of films together. And so when Jim called me as I was starting the company and asked to be involved, all of a sudden now there was Stan. So there were three founders, but, you know, the work that was really done was done by me. Jim lent his name, and Stan got lucky. He was Ringo Starr, you know? And from about 1993 to around 1997, 4 years, Jim's involvement with Digital Domain is limited because what he's doing is he's making his movies. He gets involved with Digital Domain when we're making his movies, but beyond that, nothing else. Stan is hardly involved in Digital Domain at all. So their active involvement was somewhat limited, though at the very highest level, making certain financial decisions or political decisions, I, as the president of the company, need the approval of the other two partners. And at some point in about 1997, early 1998, Jim decides, as a result of the fallout we have on Titanic, that I should no longer be the CEO of the company. And so he and Stan and I have a meeting, and Jim informs me that he feels that the company needs to hire a new president, and that the new CEO of the company would be Jim as the C, Stan as the E, and I as the O. And I realize that's the most foolhardy thing in the world. I can barely get Jim or Stan's attention. And when I have meetings with them, the attention that I get from them is they're talking about some hot starlet or what cool movie is around. You know, these are not business guys, right? So I go on a worldwide search to look for this new president. And then we have a board meeting. And at the board is Cox and IBM. There are investors. And I explain to the board that Jim and Stan have decided we need a new president, and that I've been actively looking for him. At which point, the guys from Cox and IBM, our board members, say, "What the? What?" And I said, "Well, that's what Jim and Stan want." And all hell breaks loose. And the board basically says, "I don't give a damn what Jim and Stan wants. You're the CEO of the company, and we back you." At which point, Jim pulls me out of the board meeting, and we have a screaming match, nose to nose. He's taller, but my nose is bigger. And I refuse to back down. And I guess that's never happened to Jim Cameron before. And so he comes back into the board meeting, puts his jacket over his shoulder, turns to the board, and quotes a line from Titanic. "Ladies and gentlemen, it has indeed been an honor and a privilege playing for you." And he walks out of the meeting. And that's the last I see of him. Stan turns around and looks at the rest of the people in the room and goes, "Me too!" And he leaves. And that's the last I see of him until his funeral. And that's how it ends. Wow.
Yeah. This is very interesting, because sometimes, you know, people see only the end result. They see the top movies, the, you know, Titanic. But underneath, a lot of story behind the scenes. Well, of course, the human beings, people, egos. And sometimes it's not as pretty as people think. That's the art of the effects. But it goes like this. But if we back up, before you explain exactly then what happened after Jim left, tell us, maybe there's a little anecdote. I think Jim was already, or was he, already testing stuff for Avatar? Did I hear it?
No. You know, before like, he left? You mean before he left? Well, I could tell you the Avatar story. So what happened on Titanic was, John Landau at the time, was not Jim's producer. He was the head of production at 20th Century Fox. John Landau and Jim start putting together a budget for Titanic. Now, Jim was not the Jim Cameron we know today, who had the number one and number two all-time box office films. And in fact, one of the last films that he did, which was The Abyss, wound up to be not very financially successful and incredibly expensive and over budget. So the Fox people, the Fox senior executives, were very concerned about this new movie, Titanic. And there was water involved. So as soon as there's water involved, back then, everybody got really, really concerned. But with the stamp of approval from John Landau, who was 20th Century Fox's head of production, saying, "No, the budget is vetted, it's $118 million or whatever it was," the guys at 20th Century Fox at the highest level said, "Okay, let's move forward, let's greenlight the movie." So Jim then comes back to me at Digital Domain in, I guess it was 1996, and says, you know, the budget for the film is X and the budget for the visual effects is $18 million. And I said, oh, okay, but how'd you come up with that? And he said, that's what we submitted. Which was really interesting because neither John Landau or Jim Cameron probably ever budgeted visual effects at the level a visual effects facility needs to budget it. You know, they didn't understand visual effects at the level that a visual effects company does. That's why there's visual effects companies, right? So we budgeted it, and it came in at in the high 20s. And we went back to Jim, and we said, we can't do it for $18 million. And Jim's response was, well, if you can't do it for $18 million, Industrial Light and Magic will do it for $18 million. Well, that was, you know, sort of, because here's the chairman of Digital Domain, Jim Cameron, making a movie that's greenlit, and his own company, Digital Domain, can't do the work. But Industrial Light and Magic can, which at that time was our biggest competitor, and also really important to me because I used to play on the Yankees, you know, and now I'm on a different team. So I couldn't let Industrial Light and Magic have the job for personal reasons and professional reasons. So I went to my board of directors, because after all, it's their money, not Jim's money. He didn't put any money into the company. And I said to them, this is what we face. And they looked at me and they understood that we needed to do the movie at $18 million. And so we did. The company lost a lot of money on Titanic. And actually, Titanic was not good for Digital Domain. And I think Jim was feeling guilty about it. And so at that point in time, he came back to me and he said, you know what we'll do on the next project is we'll make Digital Domain a studio that's a producing partner. I said, well, what's the next project? And he said, it's a project called Avatar. I said, all right, let me read it. So I read it. And after I read it, I thought, how the hell is anybody going to do that? Now, remember, this is 1998. Right. And I went back to Jim and I said, listen, I'm not sure we could do it, but we have to do tests. And he said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And I said, all right, so let me deal with 20th Century Fox. And I'll come up with a budget for the test. I think we came back to him for a $2 million budget for a test. And 20th Century Fox came back to us and said, okay, we'll fund it. Now, remember, they had already funded the Titanic test of the underwater thing. So that worked out well for them. Jim Cameron comes to them, asks them for a test. They do a test, and then they make the biggest movie of all time. So here now, this Avatar project, they need a test, and they say, yes. But one caveat to the test is that they own the software.
And at the end, they would own the software.
They own the software. If we make the test and, in fact, are able to make the movie, they'll own the software. Well, there's no way that was going to happen from my point of view, because chances are we weren't going to really make any money on the movie. So the only value that a visual effects company has as a result of making something is that you own the process and pipeline by which it's made.
To do another movie.
That's right. So I figured, well, if we're going to create virtual human beings, which is what this movie is all about, albeit they were 10 feet tall and blue, I wanted to own the software. So I went back to Fox and I said, no, you can't own the software. And Fox went, okay, we're done, thank you. And that was the end of it. So the rest is history, right? And Jim winds up doing Avatar. Actually, there was a t-shirt made at SIGGRAPH for 2000 in 1998. And the t-shirt is a black t-shirt, only Digital Domain, black t-shirt, and green lettering, and it says Avatar. And underneath it says James Cameron, Stan Winston Studio, Digital Domain. And we were going to be the production company of the film.
But at the end. But it also, they realized, because I've heard that other studios in town made tests for this little, maybe underneath, to realize if it was even possible in 98. And I think they realized technology was not there yet.
I think that my conjecture would be, and I don't know this for a fact, but probably the series of events was, Cameron came to me, asked us if we could do Avatar. I read it, I thought it was much too aggressive at the time, and the only way we would go forward is if we did a test to show that it could work. We got the no from Fox. They wanted to own the software. Jim, being the undaunted person that he is, then probably went to other companies and said, can you do it? Can you do it? Can you do it? And then ultimately realized that no one could really do it. And then 10 years went by. And then with Gollum, I think, on the screen, realized that Weta could do it. And interestingly enough, wound up stealing Andy Jones, the animation director, who was a Digital Domain employee, went to Weta to do the work.
So that's really interesting. We see technology on one side driving what's visible. We see the business side of it, of the visual effects industry, and this is really a tough business, even if at the end they make billions of dollars in return. Underneath, the negotiations are very hard. Even in 98, 97, before Titanic, it's still very hard. Now if we fast forward, you sold DD, you're out just before this whole thing crashed.
Right.
If you don't mind, let's talk about where we are now. It's not getting any easier. Technology has pushed us so far that now studios are even able to deal this even harder with the VFX. And recently, another studio like Rhythm News gets to its pinnacle with Life of Pi, gets an Academy Award, and then goes bankrupt. And even you are shocked by it because it was a respectable company. Everybody knew industry, they were treating their people right, they were doing things right, or supposedly. What this feeling of creating, I mean, what do you say about all this? Or what does this say about this whole industry? Or where do we stand nowadays?
Well, I've said this before, I'll say it again now to you. There's always been this conversation about the good old days. Well, I'm old enough to know, because I was in the old days. The old days were not good, they were bad. Right? We didn't really make money in the old days. You know, we'd go out and do a project, and the project would make hundreds of millions of dollars, and we'd wind up, if we were lucky, with a 3% profit margin, right? Which in a 3% profit margin some years, but a minus 7% profit margin other years, you were constantly fighting to keep your doors open. Nobody was running around making money, right? The artists were being paid. As it got more difficult to hire people, their salaries went up, but there were all kinds of abuses because they were the most expensive part of running that business. So the managers of the companies never took the position that we had a valuable product, that the product that Visual Effects had was very dear. And so we just kept giving it away. I'll underbid you, you underbid me, I'll underbid you, we'll do it for less. And ultimately, it was bad. The present days are much worse. So it went from bad to horrible. And it was at the result of horrible that we saw with the Hughes go out. And what infuriated me, you know, I sold in 2006 and really haven't been involved with the visual effects industry, you know, for about 5-6 years. But when I saw that happen, I just said, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. This is outrageous. I spent my entire life in visual effects, and good people like John Hughes, who supported thousands of people's families for years, is now broke. It's just not right. So about a week before the Academy Awards, I tweeted, wouldn't it be great if there were 500 people that showed up in front of the Academy Awards and demanded a slice of the pie? And the artists were so enraged with the failure of Rhythm and Hughes and so upset at the state of affairs. And here's this glitzy award show, and everybody's dressed up, and we're not even invited to the party. And in fact, it should be our party, because the money was made because of the work of the visual effects artists. It just was an incendiary device, and it blew up. And then the rest of the evening with the Academy Awards presentation just added salt to the wound, you know? Ang Lee not thanking anybody at Rhythm and Hughes, Bill Westenhofer being cut off, the folks from the Avengers like sort of joking about it with the shark, you know, Jaws music. It was just the perfect sort of coming together of time to wake up community. And so I started to get involved in it, and I was really, really excited. And I thought, maybe now's the time, you know. And in fact, I think the visual effects community had more leverage, possibility, than it ever had in the history of cinema. It was obvious to everybody that a movie like Life of Pi could not be successful if not for the visual effects. And it was obvious to everybody that the top movies were all visual effects movies. So I thought, given that strength, if there was leverage now that could be applied, we could win the war. And unfortunately, I've been doing that. That's like now March, April, May, June. Yeah, it's been about 5 months. And it started to, in my opinion, started to really fall apart. And everybody's afraid. And nobody's prepared to really stand up and fight the good fight.
Yeah, because it's very complicated war, right? We have no leverage. It's fixed cost. So you say it's going to cost you this amount to make your movie. And art directors and studios change their mind, but there's never additional money. There's no return.
Those are all givens. Okay, so that's the problem. Yeah. Can it be fixed? Yes. Why? Because we have the leverage. We're just not using it.
All the VFX studios, you're saying, in the world should, even in England, in Australia, in Europe, in New Zealand, all these guys should come together and maybe create a trade association with best business practices.
Change the business model. I mean, it's been done before. Let's look at what Michael Ovitz was capable of doing with actors and directors. That could happen with visual effects. Actors and directors were what Hollywood thought gave power to the box office, right? Well, today, we know what gives power to the box office. Visual effects. We know it. So we have that power. So now, rally around it, grab it, and use it. If you don't, it's over.
But Scott, there's something still that happened in the meantime. Technology got faster, broadband, which images could be shared throughout the world faster. So now the studios call for smaller places in Berlin, for example, 20 people, to do some shots on Iron Man, another facility in Bulgaria, whatever. And it now technology makes this possible. So they don't need to stay with big facilities in Hollywood. They can just split the work. So now it's difficult to get all these guys together because they can be all around the world.
I disagree with you. And here's why I disagree with you. Think about it this way. A movie studio is going to make Avatar 3, right? Or 2. Avatar 2. So how many choices does a movie studio have to create Avatar 2 at the level that an A-level director wants his creatures and characters and visual effects to be created? Well, yes, we could do, you know, bad Chinese animation. I guess you could do that. Jim Cameron's not going to stand for that. Steven Spielberg's not going to stand for that. You know, it's just not going to happen. So where do those shots get done? Yes, there are match moves that are done in India. Yes, there's simple compositing that's done in China. Yes, there might even be matte paintings that are done in Russia. But if you have a 2,000-shot show, and of those 2,000 shots, 500 of them are killer shots, where do you go? 10 places in the world. Oh. Just 10.
Less.
Yeah, that's it. You're not going to break up your show and say, okay, we'll give the female Navi to China, we'll give the male Navi to India. No, it's going to 10 places, maybe 7 places, and that's it. So now if you took those 10 places and you said, okay, we're going to discount Sony Pictures Imageworks, because they're owned by a studio, right? And we're going to discount Industrial Light and Magic, because they're owned by a studio. That now leaves 8 places. And so if 8 places, if only 5 of them said, we're not working this way anymore, it doesn't work. what happens to the 12, 20, 15, 10 pole movies that have to come out in the following year. I'll tell you, the guy who runs, you know, 20th Century Fox visual effects department, used to work for me, he's not taking Avatar to Prana Studios in India. Just not happening. So right now's the time. And if it doesn't happen now, within 5 years, he will be taking that work to Prana Studios in India.
Wow.
Yeah. The time is now.
The time is coming.
The time is now. And you know, it's takes courage to be a revolutionary, you know? It takes courage. And it's easy for me to say that because I don't make my living in that field anymore. So I understand how difficult it is for, let's say, somebody in England who runs a facility who gets tax subsidies to say, you know what, tax subsidies are bad, or let's go back and push back on the studios. You know, I understand how difficult it is. But the time, the window is closing.
I just want to touch, because I think we arrive at the end here. You expressed yourself very well. Just so that nobody's evil, because I don't think, just to touch on the studio side.
They're not evil. No, gosh, no. They're not evil at all.
It's great to say it, because I think it's the system, that extreme capitalism with no limits, that allows the studios to act like they do, because it's how the rules are. But if at the top of Marvel, you know on Iron Man 3 you're going to make some money, and you still push the margin to try to get as much VFX for the lowest cost, knowing that on this one there's no risk, you're going to make your money back, and ethically you might want to share with the partners that allowed you to get up there, the VFX companies, and say you're going to be paid more on this one, thank you very much for being with us on this. Why the top there still acts every day on trying to get the best prices? I mean, it's not his or her fault. Every morning, I don't think that person wakes up thinking, I'm going to get them for the best prices. Don't you think it's the system that allows this to happen when they think they do good? The head of Marvel think they do good when they try to get the best prices.
Yeah, it's the ethos. It's sort of like, if one could be long-range thinking, one would understand that what happens if those 10 companies are out of business? Then how do you make movies? Right? That would be like, I'm against the star system and I'm going to try to beat stars up, so I'm just going to go around and never hire any stars. You know, that might work, might not. But in the visual effects arena, we know there are 10 companies that do the A work. So if you kill those 10 companies, then who does the work, right? But that's asking somebody to be long in vision, right? And the ethos, the zeitgeist by which the movie industry works is all about now. Get it now. Figure it out now. Now, now! I mean, we've been on sets where, you know, people wind up sending packages that you could take a runner and have them go 4 blocks away, but we send it to Federal Express. Because now! You know, so it's a very dysfunctional way of running a business, but it's the ethic of the business. It's been that way since Samuel Goldwyn and Louis B. Mayer. I mean, that's the way it's been. And, you know, my mother used to have a saying, it's the pot calling the kettle black, right? And so if you, as a studio, are in the business of hiding profit because you don't want to pay participation, right? And if you in the studio define overhead as opposed to profit, then people in that zeitgeist assume you're doing the same thing in the outside. So if everything looks like a nail, all you got is a hammer. And the studio's zeitgeist, their culture, their ethos, the way in which they've worked over the last 80 years is, you're ripping me off. And so if you walk into a room and you expect to have a bar fight, you're going to have a bar fight. And that's the way in which the studios work. And I think it's up to the visual effects community, because we don't work that way, right? I think it's up to the visual effects community to either learn how to work that way, which would really be a disaster, or make the studio understand that it's not in the best interest of either one of us to be beating each other up. Maybe we could come together, and now not only will you get better effects, you'll actually get it for less money, because we're in the driver's seat with you. I mean, you know, as a visual effects supervisor, how many times a director has asked you to do something, and if you had the wherewithal and were allowed to say, you know what, Bob, let me show you another way, and Bob said, yeah, that's a good thing. Most of the time, people are afraid. They don't want to talk to Bob because he's a billion-dollar director, and he'll eat you for lunch. And so you go and you do what Bob says, only to find out that you knew wasn't going to work.
You could have made it cheaper.
That's right.
Thank you. And one last word,
yes,
because
yes.
In the middle of all that,
a word
to the VFX gypsies, because behind that, the artist, the little guy that makes these VFX, have to get their backpack now and become gypsies and go with their families from New Zealand to Vancouver to back to LA to London, back to Sydney. And that's the reality of it.
It's not sustainable. That's not sustainable.
We're mercenaries. VFX mercenaries.
62 years old, and I tell you, I have a hard enough time getting out my door and walking out. You know, at 45 years of age, the really senior people in the industry, 45, 50 years of age, you've got kids, they're going to college, they're in high school, you own a home. You cannot live your life that way. You will wind up divorced and with some severely unhappy kids and a lot of therapy charges. It just doesn't work. And so it's time to get some action and stand up and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. This is not the way it's going to work for me. And speak out and speak your mind and try to come up with solutions to make it work.
That's the art of VFX.
Yeah, sure is.
Thank you, Scott, for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.